So we are joined at this point on Speak Up Las Cruces by the president of New Mexico State University, Valerio Ferme. Is that how to pronounce your name?
Yes.
Okay.
That's fine. That's
and
good.
My wife and I were, rooting for you when they announced a few candidates because you'd, been an expert on Italian poets.
Okay, I don't know what your connection to Italian poets is, but good enough.
Well, I'm good. A lousy poet.
Oh.
And I read ancient Chinese poetry. I read ancient, not in the original,
right.
I'm afraid,
right.
Although I have a friend who translates it. But, I have an attitude toward administrators like my mentor, Orville Wanzer, who taught here long before you got here. And he said, administrators, started with Socrates. They'd, wander around the park and talk, and they needed somebody to bring the sandwiches and clean up the wrappers after.
I don't know about that, but
but
all right.
Poetry, that's a different deal.
Okay, well, good.
So I guess first obvious question is, how has your first year been going?
Well, first of all, now it's almost a year and a half because
yes.
it's maybe for the delays and everything. I think, you take some time to evaluate what's going on, looking around, try to feel a little bit what the needs are, the environment is, and you just do, you try to figure out what is something that you have the power to change, other things that you don't want to change, and then just how do you get things to move along, especially in an environment that, as you know, is under a lot of different stresses.
What surprised you most?
What surprised me most? I do want to say that I think we have great students. We have they come from very different backgrounds, and so they bring a lot of different perspectives to the environment. I think that from my relationship now with students and alumni, a great deal of respect for our faculty and their support. When they were students, I hear that a lot from the alumni, and I hear it a lot from the current students too. So I think that there's a lot of as I said, respect and value in what students are learning.
Jamie?
So you have said that you don't want to put together a sort of five-year plan like LEADS 2025 and that you're more interested in a strategic direction. What does that consist of?
So it seems pretty basic, but as a land-grant university, we have, certain almost written into our history the tradition of educating the citizens of the state, increasing and improving the research and innovation that helps the state advance, and public service. But internally, I think, and I've said this a couple of times, is really looking forward to avenues and ways to help everybody succeed at the university, whether it is, students, faculty, or staff. And I think those, you can't always separate those because there is a lot of relations that foster success across those three units. I mean, one of the things that I say, we graduate around 53% of our students over 6 years. To me, that's not a great rate. It's even worse at 4 years. And I want to start thinking about what we do in 4 years because that used to be the traditional. I mean, I think we're like at 34%. So if we say 4 or 5 years, because, students do take, I actually approve of students taking time off and coming back if they need to after a year, as long as they don't drop off, which is really the important part of it. Then you have to think, if you can increase the student success, then you are obviously doing the, what I consider the ethical right thing to do, which is get students to the finish line. But also, I mean, from a standpoint, I mean, purely base economics is the more students you have that graduate, the more students you retain, the better finances you have, which then can support some of the other missions of the university. And I know you have we have talked about this in a faculty senate meeting. Both research and public service cost the university money. So how do you finance that? You know, getting more grants is certainly helpful, but again, getting more students who complete their degrees, who have the ability to get to the finish line, helps also lift everybody else. So I think, you know, that's one thing. The other thing that I do believe is how do we improve and increase professional development at the level of staff? How do we give faculty and students opportunity to think of their leadership abilities both inside and outside of the university? So what opportunities are there to not only, you know, increase your abilities professionally internal to the university, but also outside of the university?
How is NMSU doing with faculty retention?
That you probably know better than I do. So, I mean, I will let you answer that question. I do, you know, I've been starting to tour the different departments, right? And I have felt a little bit of the, you know, we lose faculty here, we lose faculty there. That is, well, it's both a... I don't mean it disrespectfully, but it's both a given. Faculty do tend to move if they have opportunities, and there's that. But it's also a concern, right? I mean, it's also like thinking about how do we, you know, do we do better by our faculty? And, you know, I've had this question actually 2 days ago. Someone brought up the question of their salary not being adequate. I mean, they're in a research unit, and the question is, how is that research unit supporting your success? I mean, so are you able to get grants that maybe allow you to have 12-month stipend instead of 9? But also, what are we doing, again, at the level of if we can increase the number of students? You know, I was trying to make calculations about how much money would it require to adequately compensate vis-a-vis similar universities. We probably need another 2,000 students to get some of the money, the tuition revenue that would help us do some of that stuff. Do I want to go around and say to everybody, hey, we need 2,000 more students? It's not going to happen that easily. So the reality is we can do some things internally, but we also have to think more broadly about how do we get to those levels.
It's interesting that you should say that, you know, something like salaries depends on the number of students, because that was what John Floro said when he first came in 2018, you know, like, ultimately, it is our long-term goal to make the work situation here more attractive, but we're going to need to have more students first.
Yeah. I want to break in briefly just to tell people that you are listening to Speak Up Las Cruces on KTAL LP 101.5 FM. We are speaking with NMSU President Valerio Ferme. And in case you didn't know or didn't guess from the recent discussion, Jamie is also a professor. Somebody called in a question.
All right.
Some people call and ask you on.
I'll try to answer to the best of my ability.
So will the atmosphere at NMSU with the new governor continue to focus on in-state students or start attracting foreign students?
So, good question, but a much, much broader question than actually simply the level of engagement of the governor. Because as we know, international student enrollment is down across the United States for a variety of reasons, right? I mean, so, you know, I do think that we have some opportunities, but we need to you know, sort of assess what happens. The new governor, first of all, obviously we need to know who that governor is before we can make any assumptions. But I do think you know that the current status of our at least the educational investments by the state is a good one. And I mean, we have had significant support from the state in the last couple of years, maybe not in certain areas, but certainly I think that, you know, can we attract more international students? That will be a question that also
That's
depends
what I've
on
always
on international.
Thought was a key, and yeah. You know, as long ago as Gerald Thomas's presidency, right. Which you may not even have heard of, but yeah. 50 years ago or more, we were talking about that. He was yeah. trying to do it.
Yeah. No, and we had an uptick of international students, but recently we've lost a few in the last
year. Well, obviously, it's a tough time when we have a federal administration that makes being a foreigner a crime.
Well, as a foreigner, as someone who was raised in a foreign country, I understand some of those things.
Yes. One of the interesting, you know, just reading background piece on you on the university website. One of the things that's interesting about you, and would be interesting for you to tell folks about mm-hmm. this, is you. A lot of what you learned came from family, being a father and then a grandfather. But how did that, as a single man? Mm-hmm. How did it first become a thing that, oh, I want to adopt children?
So, well, you really need to go, and in the presence of a historian, I don't want to like kind of make things too simple, but, you know, you do look at history. So I look at my history. I'm one of nine kids. I grew up in a family, obviously, that valued children. But also, I had a very engaged, let's call it mother. More than my father, I will say, but my mother really was someone who was very devoted to public service, outward going, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want to take all the time, but she taught me the value of giving back. So when I, at a certain point in my life, I decided that, in fact, I was still an assistant professor, and I decided that I was going to, that I wanted to adopt, because I thought that would be something, you know, a lot had been given to me, I wanted to give back. So then I just decided that I was going to go, you know, and as I was also single and I was a gay man. So, but I went, they told me I could adopt. Initially, I wanted a baby. Then I saw all these kids who were, you know, kind of aged out from the little baby cute thing kind of thing, and decided to kind of move to the next level. And there was a kid that just struck, you know, that he had been through a lot of different things, and I will not reveal what those things were. But I decided to begin the practice of adopting him. He was 10 and three quarters at the time. Adopted him 5 years later. I adopted another boy in a very similar situation.
Has it occurred to you that you do everything in reverse, in the sense that most of us marry and then think about having children,
right.
You
yes.
had a child, and that sort of led to you yeah. having a partner.
And then, yeah, then so then I found someone who was interested in adopting, but I already had the ready-made family, so we kind of hit it off. And, you know, and given some of the situations of especially my older son, he had some challenges.
Sure.
He had three kids with a partner. And then at a certain point, basically, we were called and asked if he wanted to take in and have guardianship over my three grandchildren. Later, my other son, who was trying to raise his daughter by himself, was struggling. So we just said, send her over. So we've been now, well, with the three oldest, it's almost 7 years. And the other one has been with us 2.5 years. So.
Let me ask you another university oriented
yep,
question.
Sure.
In my view, one of the sort of eternal issues at New Mexico State, and maybe a lot of places, is trying to keep balance between athletics, which have become a professional sport, yep. really, that's attached to a university mm-hmm. for historical reasons, as opposed to the ladies and gentlemen out
right.
Recreating. And at least when I was there, that had a very negative impact on classrooms mm-hmm. and also took a lot of money, although it supposedly brought in a lot. How do you see that balance?
So two things. One is I was a former athlete in college.
And crew,
I even coached, one of those sort of more amateurish sports that probably would never get revenue sharing or a contract. Yes, I did. So I am familiar with athletics. And I think when I came here, I thought one of the things that is really clear is that athletics and academics weren't integrated. There was big separation. And that's the first issue when you see something like that. Partly because from my experience, we were pretty well integrated in the life of the university when we were athletes. So trying to bridge that gap was
crew
important.
Crew is slightly different from...
Yes, I admit, but I mean, I will say, you know, we actually had members of the football team who then would join the crew when their season was over and this kind of stuff. So even at that level, there was a lot more integration. And you know, there was both respect because we were student athletes. I mean, actually, one of the best students with a 4.0 and everything was a football player, captain of the football team. So it can be a different
situation. Who were football.
No.
By the way, I should note for a listener at my home that you went to Brown, right?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Yes. So, you know, I think it is a difficult – we're at a difficult time right now. It's difficult for athletics, especially in those big sports. It's difficult for universities as the costs of athletics keeps on going up. So differentiating revenues is really important, finding out how athletics can become more self-sustaining in some of these things. But also, I mean, as you mentioned – there is a lot of interesting interaction between sort of donor bases where donors come in because of athletics and sometimes then they shift over and start giving. And we have a perfect example in Mike and Judy Johnson who give both to the athletics and have endowed chairs, have done things for a number of different departments. You know, people can say, well, but that, you know, doesn't really balance out. You know, from my perspective, is so far it hasn't been hugely challenging. I mean, we did come in when I did come in. Athletics does have a deficit, so we're trying to figure out how to address that. But every time we see or I see donations, I try to make sure that we are taking care of athletics, students, and faculty. So I mean, those three areas I do try to make sure that.
Jamie, do you want to join the discussion on this point?
I'm under the impression that $4 million had been going from instructional and general funds to offset the athletic deficit on an annual basis.
Actually, there is a rule in the state that we cannot do. We cannot use instructional and general fund for support of athletics. So what? How does that happen, right? I mean, because money has been moving. Some of it is actually based on other sources of funding that the university gets that are not tied to instructional in general. You know, we have some monies that come from certain interest investments and things like that. There's also money that is not clear. This is even I'm admitting I'm not really clear, but some of the there is the state has a land grant endowment that disburses monies on a annual basis, and in fact, I mean, I don't know if you remember last year, because those funds keep on being consistent, we were able to eliminate a structural deficit in our ING by $2.5 million using some of that. So there is a little bit of freedom to use some of those monies
In the ING.
ING is instructional in general. Okay. Which is basically the permanent funding that we attribute to the to functions such as operational salaries of faculty and staff, et cetera, et cetera. So you know, you have to balance those things, but we try definitely not to influence how we're taking. ING funding needs to support some of the things that we need to fund there.
I'm going to switch slightly over to another topic. NMSU has an artificial intelligence institute, and yet the studies that are coming out show that when students and even younger students in K-12 use LLMs, they're kind of outsourcing their cognitive functions to them, and it means that they're less able to problem solve. So how does the university square those two things?
So two things. I guess, and I know you have an issue with these things, but And I'm actually not denying that there is a challenge with how these I mean, it does let's call it simplify the cognitive process in some ways. But I also think that it's not going away. So we need to figure out how do we balance these things, because what we're seeing is an increasing reliance, especially in the workforce, on some of these things. So the question is, how do we use our ability to understand how these processes, let's call it artificial intelligence, machine learning work, to help student understand and use their cognitive functions to not let themselves be caught into the machine, let's call it. Right. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, I've occasionally, you know, I'll say, okay, what does this, you know, I'll ask those questions occasionally to my, you know, my phone. And when I get an answer, I look at the answer and I scan it for things that I, that can be problematic, right? But I have the ability to sort of sort out what might be problematic. That's what we need to teach our students. We need to teach them how to understand that the machines are not perfect. They're not going to give them the perfect answer. And in fact, a lot of times they'll give them answers that are questionable. So how do we grow that ability in our students? Conversely, I think because they're going to be probably, not everybody's going to be an academic, so a lot of them are going to be in the workforce. And the workforce is now asking precisely for the kind of students who can understand how to operate these machines and how to make sense of the answers that they're giving. So one of the actions that I would like to do is, in fact, start looking to hire, the possibility of hiring pedagogues who understand how to instruct in these new functions to advance our capability of instructing students on how to use them. So, you know, it's kind of like the meta part, a little bit higher learning from our side in getting people to understand how to use this in disciplines or outside of disciplines.
Now, I make a limited use of the GPT chat thing in fiction writing. I don't let it write for me, but I do ask it, you know, what might the slang have been in 1935 for "I'm angry"? And it seems to me that for all of us down the road, a key issue is going to be the ethics of living with AI, which we are going to have at our fingertips or whatever.
Right.
But sort of separating what it should do for us and what we need to do for ourselves. So is that kind of what you're...
Yeah, So both of you point to the ethics of AI. I mean, the question of how can we use it in an ethical sense, and what does it mean to be ethical in the use of AI and machine learning? I mean, we know that, for example, philosophers right now are in high demand because these algorithms have put, you know, like there's the famous one of the car, right? That the car, the self-driving car that has to choose between killing the older person or the younger person, and how does it make that decision, et cetera, et cetera.
Definitely kill the younger person.
Yeah, I'd say it for myself. No, I'm joking. But I do think that that's absolutely a vital process.
I have another ethical
process.
Question for you, because my wife and I saw Palestine 1935, the film, which you probably have not seen, played at the Fountain Theater, which I hope you've discovered since you moved here. But the issue of divestment from Israeli concerns when Israel is committing what it's Israel's own best expert on genocide calls genocide. I think that's come up, and I think the university has not chosen to do that. Where does that stand, and would that be something that would be considered?
So it's interesting that you ask the question, because honestly, we don't have, I mean, the university itself isn't doing direct investments in markets, okay. Et cetera, that is actually the NMSU Foundation,
okay.
which is a separate entity. So that question is better referred to the NMSU Foundation because we have separated from the NMSU Foundation and they are the ones that do most of the investment. So we do not have the power to control how they invest at this point.
If like, I got to ask, if you normally advise them that you have a preference about something, do they ignore that?
So, again, yes, because basically okay. they have an investment firm in, I think it's in Los Angeles or in California, with which they operate, and I am not privy to any of their investments.
Somebody called in and asked, has Oracle visited with NMSU about Project Jupiter?
Oh, well, it's a good question because have they visited? If you could define what visited. So
Have they attempted to lobby?
No, so
let me rephrase the question. To what extent have the folks behind Project Jupiter made contact with NMSU and what's that contact?
So we have had some contact, and the contact was mostly on sort of the educational opportunities. I mean, two ways. One is I think in some ways, understandably, right? They need a workforce for this project. And so they're looking, are you able to develop a workforce for this project?
They don't really need much of a workforce.
Well, they do because my understanding is that they need about 700 data technicians. Okay. So if they need that, where are they mm-hmm. going to find them? And one of the conversations is how quickly could that be turned around? And mostly data technicians would come out of a community college and a 2-year right. associate degree. So that conversation is on one side. The other side, however, has been, okay, you know, from the educational standpoint, if you want to show an investment in the community, this is my sort of is, where is it that you are willing to show a responsiveness to the community by possibly supporting the funding of certain research that might, for example, get you to use geothermal instead of gas and oil? Or how do we recapture some, you know, there's all this project about how do we recapture the water, right? How do we make sure that the water stays within a closed system? Well, how do you do this for gas? How do you reduce the amount of gas that you're using? Because that seems to be the big challenge right now. So my engagement has been mostly from the educational standpoint, but even those conversations have been, I think we met once, and then we haven't heard anything. So, I mean, like that's, I mean, it's interesting that you say this because yesterday I was having precisely this conversation about, I wish that they would engage more on the educational standpoint because we do have some opportunities. I mean, we have water experts, water people who can actually do, you know, brackish water into operational water, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we have a lot of that that could actually be used to this. So has there been? It's been minimal. I am certainly open to hear more about the opportunities that could come up from the educational standpoint.
One other kind of general value question. And I know what your personal response would be, but as president, to what degree are the arts highly important to a university, and you know, will they continue to be at NMSU?
Yeah, so I just met with the Department of Art, believe it or not, 2 days ago. So this question did come up, and I said, what is significant about the arts as a land grant institution is its public service. I think given and I. You know, for some of us, the arts have always been part of our life. You know, I have a brother that graduated from the Art Institute of Chicago. I have two brothers that went to Rhode Island School of Design. So I understand, you know, the role of the arts. It's always been something that in my family we've taken seriously. But interestingly enough, I think a phenomenon that happens a lot in this country is when people get older, they come back to the arts. And a lot of times they come back to the arts because beauty and aesthetics are closer to death in some ways. And I say it in a very non-flippant way. I mean, the closer you get to death, the more you think about beauty, arts. And so what we see a lot of times is that people make investments at the end of their lives in arts that they never made at the beginning. So keeping that stream is really important. I also think that there is a value in art that is communicative about cultural challenges and issues. Last fall, I actually brought basically this consortium that does art and humanities in the public sphere to Las Cruces, called Imagining America. The topic was Providing Passage, which is a really relevant topic in a borderland region. So I think they do problematize. The arts do bring out many of the questions that sometimes are implicit in how we handle culture. So they are important to support. They're important to continue. And, you know, how we support them is going to be interesting. I think one of the things that we can do for the arts, especially in the contemporary atmosphere, is think about the creative importance that they add to our thought and our critical thinking by allowing us to think differently about certain solutions. So, you know, when people talk about STEAM, for example, you know, STEM plus A, right? STEM plus mm-hmm. arts, the creative part. And interestingly enough, the World Economic Forum has stressed the importance of the humanities and humanistic disciplines in the age of AI machine learning as a way to thinking about different solutions for how we operate with those things.
Is there anything in the works to create a separate school of all the departments that have to do with performance and art?
You know, I appreciate the question because it is kind of funny how dance is in kinesiology, which is in HESTA, right? Then there's art. Then there is something else that is it. I can't remember where music is, but it's the idea of bringing them together. You know, I think it would be great, but I haven't gotten to the point where actually we've been able to look at what would be the investment? What are the kind of things that we need to do to make it happen if and when we make it happen? And how does it affect the other units that are, you know, that would be, you know, you either pull them out from other units or you make them in a different unit. And you know that when you bring people that have been used to different things together, there's always an adjustment period. So figuring those things out, I think that could be a significant, I don't think it will happen in the next year and a half, but as we move strategically, it could be something to think about, especially as we re-envision our public service. And questions keep coming in.
What have we not been clever enough to ask you that you would like to tell our listeners? Anything?
Well, I mean, first of all, you are clever. You have figured out some of the questions to ask that, you know, that a president should be able to answer. You know, I think the question that I would ask is how have you adapted to an environment that is very different in terms of how it operates from what you're used to. Okay, I mean, I spent 20 years at the University of Colorado, 2 years at Northern Arizona, and almost 6 years at Cincinnati. What I have not experienced that I am experiencing here, and maybe it's due to the positions, mm-hmm. although I have some concerns that that's not true, is the level at which you need to engage the legislative process in yes. this state. It's a much more I don't even want to say thorough, but it's more time intensive. It's energy intensive. You have to spend a lot more time in Santa Fe than I've ever seen, you know, in positions like these, which is both a good and a bad thing. I mean, because you can actually highlight some of the great successes yes. you have to people across the state, but also it takes away sometimes from your focus on the university because you're constantly trying to figure out who is it that you need to work with at the different levels.
Now, in a later segment, 9:30 to 10, we're going to talk with a state legislator and her challenger. Any particular question I should ask them on behalf of NMSU?
Well, I will say this. Our local legislators this year did very well for us. I mean, and yeah. so the continued support of the university and looking at how to support the university is important. But, you know, every legislator has their own interest. So how do you adapt your interest to sort of support the mission of NMSU as a land-grant university is really important. So I would ask them that question. I would say, you know, so in, you know, if you know what the NMSU does as a land-grant, where do you see your interest is matching what the university is trying to accomplish?
I'll try to get that in.
Right. Okay.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
We thoroughly enjoyed it.
I appreciate it.
Hope Jamie didn't grill you too hard.
No, I think she was fine. You know, she grills me enough in Faculty Senate leadership.
I'm sure. Good for her.
But and you know, I mean, and I one of the, and I hope that what she sees is I'm trying to bring a transparency to the processes that it's, you know, sometimes you don't see it until it's there. But I'm pretty direct. I mean, when she asks me questions, I try to
come back and see us again.
All right. Well, thank you.
Future.
All right. Thank you.